Hello and welcome back to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One here on the Overtime Media Network. I'm Mark Daly, and as always, I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Mark Hamilton. We should just start calling ourselves Mark Squared or something like that.
Works for me.
It's a Mr. D or Mr. H or something. I don't know. So whatever works. But welcome back. Here we go. Back for another show, it seems. I know it's a lot of work. For the people involved in Formula One, they don't really like these double and triple headers, and to an extent for podcasters like self, it is a fair amount, an investment of time, but it's fun. Every time I think about it, it's like I'm not going to complain about something I enjoy doing, especially when there's been so much going on the past 48, 72 out, 96 hours. I mean, basically since last weekend. I mean, it hasn't stopped since Bahrain. And I'm still trying to get my head around what happened with Romain Grosjean, and so thankful that he walked away, unscathed more or less, despite the burns. But just everything that's happened since. I mean, we've had Lewis withdrawing because of a COVID test. We've had Haas announcing their drivers. We've had all sorts of speculation on who's going to sit in for Lewis Hamilton. We've been through all that little drama. There's so many different things going on. Usually at a time of year in a normal year, that you usually don't see too many things, dramatic things happening at any rate when you get down to the last couple of races of the season, especially in a year when the championship has already been decided like it has been, a couple of weeks ago. But boy, I mean, I had to sit down and kind of really sit back and try and digest everything that's happened this week because it's been crazy.
You know, you and I were talking last Thursday, and I'll be honest, I was really struggling to understand how we were going to entertain the listeners over the last couple weeks of the season. You know, the championship was decided, the constructors was decided. What are we going to talk about? And there's been so much. So the Roman situation, you know what? Ideally, that never happened, but obviously it's initiated a great deal of conversation and debate. So that was great. But to your point, it's everything that's happened this season. And honestly, you know, by Monday, Tuesday, Formula One Twitter and Formula One Reddit were absolutely on fire. And I'll be honest, I don't think anything stimulates conversation on the Formula One internet more than it does debate about who should get what seat and who should be driving for what team. And, you know, you and I talked about this a lot, but ultimately, Mercedes has won 7 of the last driver's titles, 7 of the last constructor's titles. There's not a ton to talk about in terms of championship competitiveness, but it's really exciting to talk about who's going to get which seat and who's going to replace which driver. And that whole sport of speculation and debate is so great. And honestly, I had so much fun this week just kind of going through the Twitter comments and going through the Reddit comments to get a sense of, hey, how are people interpreting these moves and these decisions? And I think one of the things that was most fun was just the debate and the conversation about who should have the opportunity to get that Mercedes seat for presumably what's going to be the last two races, probably not just this race weekend, but probably the last two races based on some quarantine issues that Lewis is going to face if he wants to go into the UAE. But ultimately, this week was a blast. It was so much fun. My head is still spinning. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to get a grip on what the lineup's going to look like this week, but what it's going to look like in Australia next spring. It's been an exciting week, and I have lots of thoughts.
Well, you know, it's so funny. If you dial it back to the end of last year, we get to Abu Dhabi, and you had the big drivers, like all the big teams were basically up for grabs. You had Seb Vettel out of a contract. Like, what's happening with Charles? What's happening with Max? What's happening with Lewis? And we just assumed that Valtteri Bottas is just going to get another rolling one-year deal at Mercedes because that just seems to be the way that that life works for Valtteri Bottas. And then, you had Charles sign that multi-year deal. Then you had Max, and then, well, Bottas got his one-year deal. Well, that was more towards the season. Lewis, that's still up in the air. And it was funny because you had Christian Horner talking at the time saying that, well, by the time that it all sort of works itself out, he said back then, I basically expect to see status quo within the top three teams. I mean, boy, was he wrong. I mean, I don't think we really expected to see Sebastian Vettel go away. And I don't think anybody expected to see Carlos Sainz. All these sorts of things in what basically seemed like it would wasn't going to be like a very silly season, you know, when you get like all this drama around the drivers moving around, but especially now, and even it's just sort of a temporary situation, just sort of like triggered by, you know, Grosjean and his accident, just the fact that, you know, he's just not healthy to drive right now. And then you have Lewis with his positive COVID test and all these things. It's just like, just when you don't think, or when you think that 2020 can't get any weirder, you know, and let's just face it. I mean, Formula One problems are very low down on the list of, you know, greater problems that, you know, humanity's facing as a whole right now. But just in general, the weirdness that 2020 has been, it just, it keeps getting stranger, because especially with Lewis, he's the last person I honestly expected to get a return, a positive COVID test, because he seems to have really tried to fly under the radar, really do everything responsible. I mean, we there was all that, you know, bit of a controversy back at the beginning of the summer with Charles and Valtteri going back to Monaco after the Austrian Grand Prix and kind of getting outside of the bubble. And then there was, you know, Seb Vettel got a bit of a slap on the wrist too, because, you know, he was seen congregating with other, you know, team personnel, I think from Red Bull, which you kind of expect, because, you know, he's got those connections, you know, but this is in the pit lane. So, you know, you could kind of see those sorts of things, you know, maybe to an extent that maybe somebody else would have. Cause I mean, Lewis, he hasn't been staying in hotels. He's been staying in his motorhome. He's really tried to do his best, you know, doing Zoom meetings for the team and stuff like that. So, I mean, that was really shocking, but, you know, it really kicked off a lot of drama. And, you know, I thought it was kind of interesting, some of the, you know, debates and some of the comments that were going around on our Twitter, because you put that poll out there. Who do you expect to see as reserve driver? And you had Nico Hülkenberg, which that's sort of a, you know, almost the default, you know, choice, just based on the way that he's slotted in there a couple of times, even though there's no, connection, you know, presently with the Mercedes. And then Stoffel Vandoorne, Mercedes driver in Formula E and also former McLaren driver. And then George Russell. And then, you know, I think some of the replies were like, oh, come on, it's going to be Stoff because he's the official reserve driver and all that. But, you know, I wasn't actually all that shocked to see that they decided to put George Russell in that car. And again, you know, you switch him out of the Williams into Mercedes for this weekend. Now you get Jad Aitken coming in to take his seat at Williams. So it just kind of makes everything, all these different moving parts, is absolutely fascinating at the moment.
The George Russell thing is interesting, because a lot of the conversation on, I guess, F1 Twitter and F1 Reddit was about the fact that really Mercedes should default to their test/reserve driver [S2] Yeah. [S1] In Stoffel Vandoorne. And let's be fair, Stoffel raced for McLaren at a difficult time for that team. They were struggling with the Honda power unit. He was paired with Fernando Alonso. So let's be honest, there probably wasn't a lot of mentorship or tutelage there. And he still raced admirably for that team, and he cashed in on a number of different points finishes. Ultimately, I think he's a very capable driver whose career probably would have been different in different circumstances. But yep. I think for Mercedes, that Stoffel Vandoorne isn't their future. They have no intention of, in a million years, giving him a full-time race seat. And I think there's still conversation. And obviously, I think most of the listeners to this show understand that George Russell is ultimately a Mercedes product, and he's a Mercedes driver who's effectively on loan to one of their partner teams in Williams. And I think for them, if they want to get a gauge on where he is from a development perspective, they have to give him this opportunity, because the challenge with him being in a Williams seat full-time is the car is so uncompetitive. It's really difficult to understand where he is in his own personal development track. Mm-hmm. And I mean, ultimately, I think we can appreciate that he outqualified his teammates every race last year and every race this year. But I don't know if that's necessarily saying a lot. But because the car is so uncompetitive, it's really difficult to understand where he is development-wise. And I think for Mercedes, if he's a potential prospect to potentially fill in for Lewis Hamilton on a permanent basis in 2 or 3 or 4 years, or likewise potentially Valtteri Bottas, they need to understand where he is. Because if they put him in this race seat for 1 or 2 races and he's not competitive and he makes some brutal mistakes, or even worse, potentially, he doesn't make mistakes and he just doesn't have the pace, then you know what? That's going to really help them understand and start mapping out their next 3 to 4 to 5 years from a driver development perspective. So I think for them, it was a no-brainer, but it was surprising to me how many people rallied to the cause of Stoffel. And I think you're right. Like Nico, it's fun to put Nico out there. He had a great couple of great opportunities with Racing Point this year, but I think George Russell makes a lot of sense both in the short term and the long term for Mercedes. And I think the other thing that's really interesting, and my buddy Randy was messaging this to me, it really puts Valtteri on the hot seat the next two race weekends. Right? Like ultimately, this is a guy that's been driving this car for 4 seasons. He's very familiar with it. He spends a significant amount of time with the engineers and the architects of that platform and that power unit. If he goes out and he can't outrace George Russell, I don't know what that says about his future as well. And the other thing that you and I talked about as well is that there's also pressure on Valtteri, because I think from a Mercedes perspective, there's an expectation that he's going to finish ahead of Max in the driver's standings. And it's close right now, and there's no guarantee that's necessarily going to happen. So I think for Valtteri, there's a lot of pressure on him the next two race weekends. One, because he needs to make sure that he finishes ahead of Max in the standings, but also he needs to make sure that he significantly outraces George Russell, because whether we like it or not, George Russell might be gunning for his seat.
Well, there's a number of interesting points that you mentioned there just now, Mark. And first of all, let's talk about where you left off there with Valtteri Bottas. I 100% agree that he is under pressure at the moment, because we all know where he is. So in comparison to his teammate, but also that he seems to be closer in terms of pace to Max Verstappen in a more superior car than he is to his own teammates in many times. And I think it's very telling that over the past 4 seasons, since he came into that team in between 2016 and 2017, pardon me, that he's always had this sort of this 1 year rolling deal. And I think that says a lot, despite what Toto Wolff and, the higher ups at Mercedes have said about Valtteri Bottas publicly in the press over the years. I think that says a lot, that they're just not willing to commit even to say 2 years plus an option or something like that. But it's just like a 1 year plus an option, even if they give him that. So I think that is very fascinating. And what is it? They're 10, 12, 11 points, something like that separates him and Max Verstappen. Now, if Valtteri goes out and has two poor weekends in Bahrain this weekend, and then at Abu Dhabi to wrap this season up, you know, that is a very doable and a very reasonable gap for Max Verstappen to close. So that's very interesting. And Valtteri also just was mentioning it himself this week, that he was saying, I'm sort of parsing and paraphrasing here, that it would be very bad if he's outperformed by George Russell this weekend. And I 100% see the logic in putting George into that Mercedes this weekend rather than keeping him at Williams and then just putting Stoffel in. And I feel sorry for Stoffel, because I think he was the right guy at the right time, or he was at the right point in his career to get into Formula One way back in 2016, whenever it was he first started up. But he just ended up with the wrong team. He was at McLaren when they were at their nadir, and you know, their Honda was still way behind on the engine development curve with the hybrid engines. Because I mean, remember when Alonso had his huge shunt in Melbourne? Was that in 2016? It must have been 2015.
Beginning of 2015 or 16? I can't remember.
It kind of blurs. But anyways, he missed. He after that accident, he missed Bahrain, which was, I think it was even 2 weeks after the Australian Grand Prix. He wasn't cleared to race. So Stoffel comes in for that, to fill in for him. And on his F1 debut, he scores a single point in P10, which I thought, you know, was very, very impressive. Unfortunately, that's almost kind of where he peaked at McLaren, and not necessarily through his own fault. I mean, you know, like I say, I mean, there was a lot of struggles they were having with the power unit, with the car. And, you know, he just wasn't, really able to stick around long enough to get, you know, before Zach Brown got that ship turned around. So you can understand, you know, like why he made the move to Formula E and getting into the Mercedes Formula E program. You know, that's a good place for him to be. But when it comes to, even though the fact that he is the test and the reserve driver for Mercedes, like you say, it says a lot that they're not willing to put him into the car for these kind of couple of races, and it really doesn't look like he's going to get a shot again with them in Formula One. But again, you got to take it from the look at it from the bigger picture. To me, Stoffel Vandoorne is already a known quantity. We've seen him in a couple of seasons in Formula One. We kind of know what he's all about. But like you were saying about George Russell, here we go, young driver. He's been in which is without question the worst car in Formula One for the past several seasons, and we're not sort of talking like Mercedes to Red Bull kind of like a gap in performance. We're talking several seconds a lap deficit compared to the rest of the field. So it is the perfect opportunity, like you say, to take a guy like George Russell, take him out of Williams, take the whole Williams story and where they go from here. That's a completely different tangent, but take him out of that car, put him into Lewis's car for this race and the next race if that's what it takes, and then you should get a really good a really good indication of where this guy is, because it's a little bit kind of hard to compare him to Nick Latifi at the moment, because Nick, young driver as well, first year in Formula One, also driving in a car that isn't the greatest and driving in a car that isn't designed for him. So he's got a lot of things that are kind of stacked against him, so you can kind of understand why there would be some differences between them. But I don't want to take away from what George Russell has done, especially getting that very uncompetitive Williams into Q2 regularly throughout the season, I think is very, very impressive. But now you have the perfect opportunity, like you said, Mark, is to take your prospect, this young driver, put him in the big team, and let's see how he goes. And again, just like Bottas is under pressure from Max Verstappen, he's going to be looking over his shoulder on the other side too at George Russell over the next week or possibly a couple of weeks here to make sure that he doesn't get outperformed by the young whippersnapper, as it were.
Yeah, I really agree with I think every single point you made, and I think the other thing to consider here as well is I think ultimately, I don't think George Russell is happy at Williams. I think he's in a complicated position because he's a Mercedes driver. He's been a part of their academy, but ultimately there hasn't been an opportunity for him at the Mercedes side. Now, that said, I think Williams is happy to have him. I think they are ecstatic that he's a part of the team. I think they're excited that he's going to be a part of their team next year. But I think ultimately, if they were to have blocked this move, if Mercedes came to Williams and said, look, we need this guy on loan for a race or two races, and Williams intervened, I think that would permanently destroy that relationship. And I think likewise, if Mercedes hadn't gone to Williams and asked for Russell, I think that would have caused a great deal of strain on the relationship between Russell and Williams, because I think Williams is looking at this Russell is looking at the situation with Williams, and I think he's struggling to understand why Bottas has that seat and he doesn't. Mm-hmm. And I think Bottas, and to be fair to Bottas, I don't think Mercedes brought him over from Williams for the 2017 season with any expectation or desire that he would compete for the driver's title. I think they were in a situation where they had the best driver in the championship. They wanted to create an environment where he could flourish, but they also wanted to make sure that they were also a lock for the Constructors' title championship. And I think for Russell at this point, I think he's probably starting to look at the situation and say, look, I'm wasting away at this team. Like, I put in 40 races for Williams. I'm going to put in another 60 races next year. When is this going to end for me? And I think it's interesting, and you keep stressing the fact that Mercedes doesn't want to commit anything more to Valtteri Bottas than these one-year deals. And I think this is partly it. And I really think that if Russell excels over the next couple of race weekends, I think this is really going to help predetermine what the next 2 or 3 years is going to look like for Mercedes from a strategy perspective. I think the other thing to add quickly, and I just want to touch on this one last time, but hashtag humble brag, but my wife and I were at the Williams factory in September of 2016, and all of the buzz in that factory, because it wasn't clear who was going to be racing for that team the next year. They knew at that point that Felipe Massa was going to be finished, so he'd already announced his retirement, and they were trying to understand who they were going to pair Valtteri Bottas with. But all of the buzz in the factory was around Stoffel Van Dorn, that mm-hmm. this is the guy they wanted. This is the guy that they had identified as the next up-and-coming bona fide superstar. Now, in hindsight, because I kept mentioning Lance Stroll, like, what about Lance? What about Lance? He's being linked to this team in the media. I think a lot of what they were saying at the time was smokescreen. Like, ultimately, I think on the factory floor, they probably wanted Stoffel Van Dorn because they possibly saw more capability and potential in him than maybe they did in Lance. But ultimately, I think from an executive level, it always made more sense to bring in Lance because he was going to bring in some significant investment with him from his father. But yeah, I think you're right. Stoffel was the right guy at the wrong team, wrong time for the wrong team. But I think in this situation, it just makes sense that it's going to be Russell going to Mercedes. And I cannot wait. And this is a car he's tested before. I cannot wait to see what he looks like in free practice one. And I don't put a ton of stock into free practice one or free practice two. But come Friday, I'm going to be all over it because I want to see what his times look like. And I want to see how quickly he can start putting down some competitive laps. Because again, if he has a soft weekend and he has a soft weekend on Abu Dhabi, assuming that he gets that drive again, I think it's also going to say a lot about what his future is going to look like.
Absolutely. All right, time for a quick break here on the Overtime Media Network. Still lots and lots and lots of things to talk about. We've barely scratched the surface about, you know, of all the things on our list. So hang around, don't go anywhere. We'll be back in just a moment.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right. Well, welcome back to the show. And we're talking Formula One, obviously. And Mark, where do we go from here? We've been talking about Lewis testing positive for COVID. We've talked about the whole what do you want to call it? Saga, mini saga, drama, I guess, with getting George Russell into the car. Why don't we talk now? Because, of course, there is a lot been said since the Bahrain Grand Prix last week about Romain Grosjean and his nasty, nasty, frightening accident. Fortunately, Romain is now out of hospital. He's had burns on the back of his hands. Just frightening. I mean, the final numbers on his accident, he hit the barrier at 137 miles an hour, and the impact force of when he hit that that Armco was more than 50 G's. I mean, 50 times the force of regular force of gravity. I mean, that is just absolutely stunning. I mean, fortunately, no fractures or anything else like that. I mean, the safety devices on that car really did what they were intended to do, and great to see him, back on his feet and just with the with the burns on his hand, which is that's literally best case scenario. So Romain was saying now that he's not necessarily going to rush back to get in the car for Abu Dhabi in a couple of weeks, because it's really up to how his left hand heals over that time, because he's got some swelling on that hand, and it just has to do with that. I mean, I'll be perfectly honest, and people who've listened to the show for a while will know that I'm not the hugest fan of Romain Grosjean as a driver, but certainly I think it's unfortunate that if this is his final race for Haas and possibly his final race in Formula One, it's kind of sad that his career, at least with the team, if not in Formula One, might actually be that first lap of the Bahrain Grand Prix.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've never been a huge advocate of Romain Grosjean. And I was very vocal about my surprise when the Haas team elected to bring him back for 2020. But all of that said, it's heartbreaking in a way that he doesn't necessarily get to go out the way he would like to go out. And yeah, I think whether it's a competitive finish or a points finish, I just think ideally you finish your career, in control of the car, bringing it across that finish line. And I think for him, you know what, his perspective may be completely different. Like, hey, alternatively, my career could have ended very, very differently. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy that this is the way ultimately it ended. And thank goodness for the halo. You know what, I'm awesome. I'm going to go back to France. I'm going to do media. I'm going to do all sorts of other kind of stuff. Because the other thing that's really interesting that came out over the last week or so is his personality. And his personality really seemed to glow. And, you know, he was really, really, really upbeat when he was being interviewed, and the photos of him in the hospital and the social media posts and the interviews that he was doing on French TV and with the Formula One press. Like, from a personality perspective, there's a lot more there than I thought it was. But I was really, really heartbroken that this is the way his career could end.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he has his health. It could have been much, much worse. And now he can pursue other racing if he wants to. He can go into Formula E. He can look at DTM, all these different options. Obviously, he's not necessarily a young driver, but I think somebody with as much Formula One pedigree as he has will open a lot of doors, both in other competitive racing circuits, but also from a media perspective as well. So again, not historically the biggest fan, surprised they brought him back this year, but ultimately happy that he's got a bright future ahead of him outside of Formula One.
Yeah, I've always kind of found him, not that I've seen a lot of him out of the car, but when I have seen him like out of the with the helmet and gloves off and all that, I've thought that he's always had a bit of charisma about him. But certainly, yeah, it can't be the most ideal way to get out of the, to go out of the sport. Anyways, he has talked a little bit about the incident, you know, that he had last weekend. And he said that, you know, he made some, you know, like you were saying, some of the things in the media. He was joking about how his hands look like Mickey Mouse's hands, what with all the bandages on them and things like that. Anyways, he had to say, quote, "I don't know if the word miracle exists or if it can be used, but in any case, I would say it wasn't my time to die. It felt much longer than 28 seconds. I see my visor turning all orange. I see the flames on the left side of the car. I thought about a lot of things, including Niki Lauda. I thought that it wasn't possible to end up like that, not now. I couldn't finish my story in Formula One like that. And then for my children, I told myself that I had to get out. I put my hands in the fire, so I clearly felt the burning on the chassis. I got out, and then I felt someone pulling on the suit, so I knew I was out." End quote. So, I mean, that is some pretty frightening stuff, you know, that he related there, and just, you know, just that one brief quote. But, you know, it's just going back to, you know, what, you know, even at the risk of rehashing what we talked about in detail just a couple of days ago. I mean, when you see that too, just the amount of fire, and especially it depends which angle you're looking from, especially from the camera that was sort of on the infield, and all of a sudden you sort of see him pop up over the barrier, and then he's being pulled across by the safety personnel. That was something. But the the camera that was on the grandstand side, you sort of this frenetic action of something, and then you see him, and then it was something that we don't want to see again, obviously, anytime soon. And Jean Todt, president of the FIA and also a former, you know, team principal at Ferrari, said that he called the whole situation about the fire scary. And I mean, there is no other real word that you can use to describe the situation, because we all know about the history in Formula One. We all know in decades gone past just how dangerous the sport was. And for, you know, especially, you know, in the 70s, 60s and before, I mean, it was not unusual to have drivers over the course of the season, you know, grievously injured and seriously injured, or even to lose their lives in several instances over the course of a year. I mean, you know, fortunately, fast forward several decades, and I mean, the technology, the materials, and the safety innovations that have built into Formula One really have made all the difference. I mean, we've seen the halo prove its worth several times since its introduction a couple of years ago. But the thing that was frightening about that was, I mean, it was one thing when you saw that first lap when they'd actually switched the camera from a production point down to the end of that straightaway. You saw the field coming down towards that next corner, and you saw one car shoot off across the side of the track. I mean, we were all like, oh boy, who's that? But I mean, when we saw that big ball of fire, I mean, my heart stopped, and it was frightening to see. So, I mean, obviously, I mean, that was, it was an instant stop to go from 137 miles an hour to zero in the blink of an eye. And of course, there was going to be, you know, something catastrophic happening. And of course, from the best point of view, it was just the survival cell separating from the rear part of the car with the engine. But of course, the scary part, like Jean Todt said, was just the fire itself, that 2 liters of fuel that was in that collector or whatever. And then the way that ignited and then erupted into that huge fireball and caught fire in the way that it did. I mean, nobody expected to see that happen in a 2020 in a modern Formula One car.
Not at all. I was reading a really great article that was written by one of the trackside photographers at Bahrain, and he said that, you know, he was probably 200 or 300 feet away from the impact when it had happened, and his initial instinct was he wanted to run towards it because he wanted to be able to capture, not capture the horror of the moment, but again, he's effectively a journalist. He's a photojournalist. He wants to be there. He wants to understand what's happening, and he said he got within about 100 feet of the incident. And he couldn't even get closer because it was like walking into a furnace, and he was 100 feet away. So I just want to be clear that for those trackside marshals, for the medical staff that were on scene and were feet away from that, from the safety cell, like, unbelievable, because this photographer speaks in the fact that I couldn't get closer than 100 feet because it was like walking into a furnace. Mm. And you're absolutely right. It's remarkable that so little fuel could create so much devastation. And the other thing that I've seen a number of times, and I think we retweeted it on the Instagram feed, was there's been a couple of folks that have engineered a reimagining of what had happened in the moment when the safety cell effectively pierced the two Armco barriers. Mm-hmm. And you can see how the halo effectively lifted the upper Armco barrier up and over Grosjean's head. And what's remarkable about that is when the FIA and Formula One and Liberty were campaigning and exploring different types of safety hardware options in 2014, 15, and 16, I don't think anyone had ever considered that the halo could be used to part Armco barriers to save a driver's life. Like, for all the things that it was thought to be able to do, this was never one of them. So no. It's just remarkable that in the moment when it was needed most, in a circumstance where it could never have been engineered, it was the perfect safety solution. But ultimately, again, I've probably rewatched it countless times. I think it's an unbelievable story. But to your point, I'm really curious about a couple of things. One, what the ultimate outcome of the investigation is going to be. But two, does this spur or push forward the concept of greater electrification in the sport? And I think you and I have talked about this before. I think from a Liberty perspective, there's a lot of passion to continue with some sort of hybrid arrangement in these cars. I think they speak to the thermal efficiency of what they've been able to build with these hybrid power units. But ultimately, maybe this is one of those things that kind of pushes them a little bit closer to electrification long term, because, hey, you know, one, it's maybe the right thing to do from a marketing perspective, because you look at places like we live and places like Quebec and countries in Western Europe, there's countries that are outright legislating that only electrical passenger vehicles will be sold in 2030 moving forwards. And mm-hmm. if I'm Formula One, I look at this, I'm like, does it make sense for me as a Mercedes or Ferrari to be producing a hybrid car for a racing series when the cars that I have to sell to the end user, to the consumer, have to be fully electric? Like, maybe this is one of those things, and this is just more speculative because it's nothing I've read, but maybe this is one of those moments that, an inflection point, if you will, that kind of pushes the sport closer towards electrification. And in a sense, it's a shame because I'm obsessed with the current arrangement. I love the 1.6 liter V6 turbo hybrid. I love it. I love the technology. But I also appreciate why, for the future and the sustainability of the sport, why maybe they have to look at other options. And what's remarkable about this is we're, 30 minutes into this podcast, and we haven't even started to talk about Haas's new driver lineup for next year, which on any other week would have been the leading story, right?
Well, I mean, exactly. I mean, but it is just goes to show you again just the amount and the magnitude of the news that has just been coming out since the last Sunday. I mean, it really has been a week like none other, especially, like I say, at this time of the season when the championships are both done and they're wrapped up. It's all nicely tied up with a bow. And I mean, it is just so amazing to talk about these things. But to even just to stick with, and we'll talk about Nikita Mazepin and Mick Schumacher in a while. We're going to get there, obviously. I mean, we'd be dereliction of duty if we don't talk about that. But, you know, just sticking with Grosjean, you know, Danny Ricciardo, he's just not letting go of this whole TV replay thing. I mean, he's been very critical about the fact that once Grosjean was, you know, he was rescued, he was okay, that he was very upset that the fact that they showed the replay from so many angles and just the numbers of them. So anyways, F1, they believe that they followed all the right protocols, showing the replays once they were completely satisfied beyond a doubt that Roman Grosjean was safe, he was uninjured. And they've offered to open a dialogue and explain that to Ricciardo because he wants to talk about it. But, you know, I have to disagree with Ricciardo. I completely respect and understand his point of view as a driver, that if you have a big moment like that, that's maybe not something you want to share, especially, you know, I completely get it. But I mean, in the situation when, you know, Grosjean is okay, he's not hurt, and fortunately nothing, you know, worse than that. I certainly don't have an issue with that. I mean, you know, had something happened to him where he was physically harmed, even to, you know, say he broke both his legs and, you know, there were some, you know, awkward moments or something where they're trying to get him out with the jaws of life or something like that, you know, that certainly lacks a, you know, lacks taste, for, you know, lack of a better term, right? So, you know, honestly, I don't have a, you know, a problem with it, because I mean, I think in this case is different, because I remember years ago, and, you know, I'm wearing Michael's hat here, when he had his accident at Silverstone about, what was it, 20 years ago, where he ended up breaking his legs. And I remember they were showing some camera angles from like from way down Hangar Straight, and they had like some track workers holding up some tarps and stuff like that. And then eventually they just panned away, and you never really saw anything more than that. And then you never did see anything of him getting out of the car. Then, you know, I think it's some point you saw an ambulance driving off the track, and then eventually a helicopter taking off or something like that. If somebody's hurt, I think that's fine, you know, and I think that's appropriate. You don't want to see somebody when they're in distress, when they're at their most vulnerable. That's just not the right thing to do. But I think where Grosjean's accident is much, much different is just the magnitude, just the, you know, the whole entire situation, and then all of a sudden he gets out of it, and he's, for, you know, except for the, you know, the burns that he had on the back of his hands, which we found out about later on. I mean, for all intents and purposes, the guy is okay. And I think it's just a very normal and a very human reaction to say, well, that should not have happened. That guy should not have walked away from that car like that. Like, what happened? I need to see what happened. And I honestly don't have a problem with them doing that in that situation where the guy's injuries are, you know, almost best case scenario. And I mean, he's not, you know, grievously injured. He's not bleeding profusely or something like that. So I have to respectfully disagree with Daniel Ricciardo on this one.
I'm really, really mixed on this one, you know, and we talked about this a little bit shortly after it happened, because Daniel was very, very quick to voice his displeasure immediately following the race. And to be totally honest, I was pretty surprised he was even aware at that point how much exposure this was getting. I think you're right. And you know what, if you look at the F1 broadcast, the race directors did a great job. Immediately after the crash, they cut away and they showed nothing more until it was clear that he was clear of the scene and that he was healthy and he was standing. So I respect what they did from a directing perspective when it came to the actual race. I think ultimately, obviously, a lot of viewers were very interested and curious and trying to understand what had happened. And I think ultimately, Formula One had a duty and a responsibility to their viewers to help them understand what had happened, right? Like, yes. Ultimately, we understand that Formula One is an incredibly dangerous sport and things can happen. And I think for them to have just excised that from the race and not covered it in a responsible manner would have been, to your point, a dereliction of duty when it came to serving the fans of the sport. I think I think ultimately what they did was appropriate. And I think obviously had Grosjean been injured or if the outcome hadn't been favorable, I don't think any of that footage would have seen the light of day.
No,
and I don't think any of us would have challenged that it was not the appropriate thing to do, but he was healthy. He got out of it okay. It may have been a miracle, whatever the circumstances were, but I think it's important that the fans see this and that we continue to understand. And seeing that also reinforces the danger of the sport, that we think that Formula One in 2020 is a fundamentally different place than it was in 1980. The tracks are engineered differently. The cars are engineered differently. The driver suits are differently. The flame-resistant materials are different. The helmets are different. I think we sometimes take for granted that Formula One's just in a much, much better place, and fireballs and cars separating was something in the 1980s, the early 1990s. So I think it was also good because it helped reset our calibration better calibrated our expectations of how dangerous this sport mm-hmm. can continue to be. I think the one thing that did throw me a little bit is, and I've credited Liberty for this over the past couple of years, is that their social media game is much, much better than it has been in the past. And they're really great at cutting and dropping samples and scenes and cuts from the races onto Instagram and onto Twitter. I was a little bit uncomfortable with how they were positioning the crash for clicks on social media in a way that seemed a little bit exploitive to me. This is something that you usually reserve those drops and those tweets and those Instagram posts and those stories for. It's a great overtake, or hey, you know what? It was a little bit of contact in the corner, but he got through, or it was a DRS zone, like those kind of things. And for them to kind of, that felt a little bit exploitive to me, but ultimately that may have been their social media team, and it may not have been something that, you know what, from an executive perspective, they sat down and had a lot of time to conversate about. But ultimately, I agree. I think that from a broadcast perspective, the director did the right thing when they understood and learned that he was healthy and he'd escaped the scene. You had a duty to your viewers to help them understand and break down what had happened.
Yeah, absolutely. And you raised a couple of good points there, Mark. And one of them, I think the one thing that sort of popped into my head when you were talking about it is, despite all the changes and improvements that they made, is that they haven't completely sanitized or removed that element of danger. It just really illustrates how dangerous Formula One is, despite all the improvements and all the innovations that have come in over the years. Anyways, time for another break here on the Overtime Media Network. And what do you say? Should we talk about Haas and their new driver lineup after the show, you know, some 40 odd minutes?
Can we please?
I think we have to. I will do so right after the break. So don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the show, and welcome to all of you watching also on YouTube. We're posting all our shows on video. So if podcasts aren't your thing, be sure to head on over to YouTube and search us up at Scuderia F1 Pod, or I think it's just Scuderia Formula One on YouTube, and check it out. So yes, we've talked about it, or we've hinted at it quite a bit over the past 40 minutes or so. But let's talk about it now. So it has finally been confirmed, and Gunther Steiner was saying this not so long ago, that they would announce their driver lineup for 2021 before the end of the season. And I guess that maybe the situation with Romain Grosjean definitely being out for Sakhir this weekend, and possibly for Abu Dhabi in a week from now, you know, I think that's really kind of forced him to play his hand a little bit, because obviously they need to do something about that as well. And of course, so the driver lineup, because neither Grosjean or Kevin Magnussen are coming back, and that's been a partnership they've had at Haas for a couple of years. So obviously those two guys are not coming back for 2021, and they've announced a driver pairing of Nikita Mazepin and Mick Schumacher. And of course, Mick Schumacher, if that name sounds familiar, and shame on you if it doesn't, because he is the son of seven-time world champion, and the guy whose hat I'm wearing this evening, Michael Schumacher. And if you said Ralph Schumacher, I mean, sit down and shake your head. You just got the wrong Schumacher in your mind. But I guess Ralph won a couple of races, but definitely there was a big separation between the two Schumacher brothers. And I think that ultimately is going to be very interesting. I mean, Mick has done pretty good in F2 over the past couple of years, you know, Ferrari Academy driver. And obviously he has the name that really and the pedigree to get into that system. system. But it's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, going from a guy, you know, a pairing of drivers, you know, obviously an extremely, experienced driver Roman Grosjean, and also, a somewhat, I'd say, experienced journeyman in Kevin Magnussen, you know, who's not new to Formula One either, being into his mid to late 20s as well. But going, it kind of sort of perpetuates this youth movement that we've seen in Formula One over the past couple of years, with your Charles Leclerc's, your Max Verstappen's, your Alex Albon's, and guys like that. And I guess obviously there must be a couple of things going on there with Haas. You know, Nikita Mazepin is a young driver, but he's bringing a lot of money with him, which kind of, you know, that whole pay driver debate kind of rears its ugly head again. And I think there's pros and cons, and there's a lot of back and forth that you can have with that, because I mean, you could make that argument to a certain extent with a guy like Checo Perez, who has all that Telmex money that he brings, and I mean Checo's a decent Formula One driver, don't get me wrong, but at times you can see that. And I mean, we've seen that also so far in the past with our compatriot Lance Stroll, and obviously with his dad's money obviously helped him get into Formula One. But I always say that, despite the money that you might have, you still have to have some talent, because if you're a complete hack that can't even put their pants on the right way or tie up your shoelaces, even if you have all the money in the world, you're still not going to get into a Formula One car. In some cases, it might, put you ahead of somebody that might be more talented as a driver than you are, that maybe lacks that sponsorship money. So, yeah, I know, I understand it. But anyways, it's going to be an interesting situation to watch at Haas for 2021.
I couldn't agree more with your assessment about the current infusion of young talent in Formula One, and the timing couldn't be better. And not only do we have this unbelievable influx of young talent into Formula One, but from a personality perspective, if you look at George Russell and Norris and Albon and Latifi and Lance Stroll, these are great kids, whether they're an academy driver or whether they're a pay driver. These are great kids. They're great on social media. They're doing a ton of work to bring a younger demographic into Formula One. And I think the great thing about Mick Schumacher is he fits right into that category of young, talented drivers that are also just great human beings. And I think that's one of the things I'm really excited to see. And to recap, you spoke to the fact that he's had some success in Formula 2. This is a guy that won the Formula 3 European Championship in 2018. He made the move to F2 last year. And I think from a media perspective, that's when a lot of people started paying attention to him. And 2019, by an F2 kind of standard, wasn't a really competitive championship, not in the sense that somebody ran away with the championship, but there wasn't a lot of talent. 2018 was crazy because you had George Russell and Lando Norris and Alex Albon and Nyck de Vries and Nicholas Latifi. Like, it was a really stacked championship in 2018. 2019 was a little bit different. You had Nyck de Vries and you had Nicholas Latifi finishing 1-2, and there wasn't a whole lot of depth beyond that. So Mick's first season was maybe a little bit disappointing when he finished 12th. He's really rebounded this year, and Formula 2's a little bit more competitive than it was the year before, so it's nice to see that he's leading the championship. Obviously, he hasn't won the title yet. There's a couple of races left, but he's in a really great position to do it. And even if he doesn't, he's got a huge number of podiums this year. He has a couple of race wins. He's looked very competitive. He's been ultra reliable. He's only had one retirement. He's been great in qualifying. He's had a really great season, and it's been great to see. So not only is it a tremendous story for Formula One that we've got this ultra-talented young driver from Germany entering the sport who's got this absolutely unbelievable Formula One lineage, he's also a great guy, and that's really exciting. I think the flip side of this is that from a Haas perspective, there's a little bit of Jekyll and Hyde here, in the sense that you get this phenomenally talented young driver with this unbelievable lineage, and don't think for a minute that this move wasn't based on the fact that he's a Ferrari Academy driver and the long-term goal is to have him racing for the Ferrari team, the Scuderia. Like, there's no question that that's the long-term goal here. But the decision to bring in Nikita Mazepin is one that I find not baffling, because I get it when you talk about economics. Like, this is a this is a pay driver. His father's extraordinarily wealthy. There's already a pretty well-established commercial tie-up between his father's company and the Haas team. I think Haas is in a vulnerable position, right? Like, this is a team that joined Formula One 3 or 4 years ago. Gene Haas sunk a ton of capital into this team. Outside of a competitive first half of their first campaign, this team hasn't delivered in any meaningful way, despite the fact that they've had a really close relationship with Ferrari when it comes to integrating Ferrari developed parts into their car. And I think for Gene Haas, you know what? I don't think he has a ton of patience left. So I think this was a move where, hey, look, we get the good of bringing in Mick Schumacher and all of the positive shine that that's going to bring onto the team and all of the positive press and the exposure that's going to come with that. But with Mazepin, you know what? Again, he's currently third in the F2 championship. His results in Formula 3 and Formula 2 are mixed. He's not as credentialed a driver as Mick Schumacher or a Latifi or a Stroll or a Russell. But ultimately, he brings a ton of money into this team. Now, what's really troubling about this decision is, one, his father's still tied up with a fairly complicated lawsuit with Lawrence Stroll because he still argues adamantly that he had put in a more competitive bid for Force India back in 2018, and that's now actually going to trial. So there's some ugly friction there. But furthermore, Mazepin has a really checkered past as a human being in Formula One on and off the track. This is a guy who, you know, I had to dot this down because as much as I want to shine up some of these young drivers and all the great things they do, I think it's worth mentioning that Mazepin has a pretty mixed history. This is a guy who on social media wished COVID a happy birthday. This is a guy who punched Callum, I think a lot. I always forget how to pronounce his name, but the gentleman who's currently second in the F2 championship, this is a guy who punched him in the face and severely damaged his eye socket and his jaw following a little bit of a skirmish during a practice session. This is a guy who has defended racists on social media. This is a guy who's been on social media and has been documented for willing to trade paddock passes for nudes with some of his female fans. This is a guy who threw a party the same day that a number of miners were killed working in one of his father's mines. This is a young driver with some, I would say, maturity issues. And I'm very curious to see how this is going to translate on the track. There's no question he's a capable driver, but more than I would say a Nicholas Latifi or Sergio Perez or a Lance Stroll, I really strongly believe he got this seat not on merit, but on cash. And ultimately, Lance Stroll has proven his doubters wrong. He's a guy who has podiums. He possibly could have won a race if not for issue with his front wing a couple of weeks ago, but he's done some great things. And Nicholas Latifi, it's too early. Sergio Perez, you mentioned, you know, ultimately people forget that he's very much a pay driver as well with that Telmex capital, but he has time and time again reassured us that he deserves a place on a competitive Formula One team.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Mazepin, I don't know. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on this guy.
Yeah, it really is interesting that, I mean, there's several things I want to touch on that you just mentioned, but it is interesting. Like the one thing that immediately popped into my mind when you were just going over all those different list of names, that certainly over the past couple of years, F2's loss has definitely been Formula One's gain. When you see, drivers like Norris, Stroll, and, you know, it just sort of keeps going on, your Albons, your Latifis, and you're starting to see this, you know, as you kind of see the ebb and flow in F2 over the past couple of years, as these guys kind of like percolate up through the different formulas into Formula One, you can really see how it's really benefiting Formula One now. But I mean, where is it going to be in a couple of years when these guys to start to, you know, really get into their prime? They've got a couple of years of Formula One under their belt. And you were just making a good point with Lance Stroll, because he comes into Williams at a point where they're, because I mean, this Williams was like this, and then their performance wise, they just cratered. Exactly. That is the ideal word to describe where they went sort of post 2017. And then, so he goes there, then he goes, ends up at Force India slash Racing Point or Racing Point slash Aston Martin. And, you know, he's in a car that's not designed for him in a team that isn't in the greatest financial, waters as it is. I mean, it's going to be a different story now. What with the, his old man's money and the whole Aston Martin thing. I mean, that's going to be interesting to watch. I mean, we're starting to see, despite all the unfortunate things that have happened to Lance this year, you're starting to see some of what he has. So he's going to be an interesting driver to watch. And of course, we're going to be homers to a certain extent for guys like Nick Latifi and Lance Stroll, because, that's just what we do, right? But it's going to be interesting to watch them. But, certainly the Haas situation, and I said on the show, as soon as they'd announced that they were not going to bring back K-Mag and Rogro for 2021. And this is a team that obviously, they've got issues with the money. This is a team that's basically flatlined and, actually it was more than flatlined because they're just not, they're not going anywhere. They're regressing in terms of where they came into the sport in, what was it, 2016. But, the thing is, they needed, like I said, they needed a change. They needed a brush of fresh air. They needed to do something in that team. And the easy thing, it's like in any other sport, you're struggling a little bit, fire the coach. Fire the coach, get a new coach in there and see what happens on the field or on the court or whatever, right? So, I mean, it made sense, from the driver's point of view to bring in something. And Mick Schumacher, for a number of reasons, makes sense to bring him into Haas. I mean, he's a young up-and-coming talent with the lineage, like you say. He's doing well in the other formulas that he's raced in. I mean, you got that Ferrari connection. So that makes sense. But, the guy that's going to be sitting across from him in the garage now, yeah, it's a bit of a head scratcher, and unfortunately, when you bring to light all those unfortunate things that have happened both on and off the track, especially for a guy for such a young age at from where he is, I mean, it's not a great look, unfortunately, in that sort of way, but. You have to hope that maybe this is a wake-up call for him, that he matures and puts his head on his shoulders properly, because any one of those incidents that you just mentioned, you're like, most people are like, dude, what are you thinking? But when you put all those together, it paints a much bigger picture, and the picture isn't a very pretty one, especially when you compare it to the guy that he's going to be teamed up with for next year. But just as talking about this sort of crop of younger drivers, one guy that almost gets a little bit, I don't want to say overlooked, but I think it's just from the point of view that I think that we're maybe just used to him by now, is Carlos Sainz. Because, I mean, he's been in Formula One for a couple of years now, and, I mean, he's still not really, he's not too much older than these other guys. So that's going to be, I mean, it's interesting, it's going to be to watch, like, say, the Strolls and the Latifis and the Norrises and guys like that next year, and George Russell. I mean, there's so many of these different names. I'm forgetting poor old George there. It's going to be maybe just kind of interesting to watch Carlos, who's maybe just that sort of half a generation older than these than some of these other guys, next year. I mean, there's just so many different fascinating things. And I want to touch on it too, but we're late to take one final break here on the show. So why don't we just do that now? We'll come back and we'll pick this up on the other side. So don't go away. We got a lot more to talk about here on the podcast. It's always Up to Speed with Formula One. So we'll be back in just a moment. All right. Well, welcome back to the show. So where do we pick it up from here? How do we tie this one up nicely? I mean, in such a busy and crazy week that, there's still so many things that are, that are really to talk about. I mean, I'm just looking at my notes here. There's one picture that I have of Mick Schumacher, and boy, you can really see the resemblance. The force is strong with this one. I mean, you can see a lot of his dad in him, and that whole situation with Michael, and the fact that he horrifically injured himself several years ago. That's always one that I have such difficulty reconciling. For a guy that was so successful in everything that he did to have such a tragic accident, and I was always of the opinion that I always thought that once Michael was done with Formula One, regardless, I think he would have gone away. I mean, we still would have seen him, but I don't think that that they would have really been in the spotlight as much after he left Formula One for good. So, I mean, that's what makes his accident all that more tragic. But, you know, it's, you know, having said that, I mean, it's exciting to see, you know, see his son coming into Formula One now. And, you know, it's I guess, you know, there's a lot of metaphors you could do or you could use in this situation, but it's going to be really interesting to see how he does with Haas. And I mean, there's, I guess for them, you know, just where they're at, maybe it's kind of a low risk kind of thing because, you know, they're bringing in some younger and inexperienced drivers. But still, I mean, I guess it's a good way for Mick to get his toes wet in Formula One. And you have to hope that that what they do next year, that that maybe that there's going to be a bit of a progression because, I mean, obviously they got some issues with the car, but of course the other issue is that they got a Ferrari engine in the back, which isn't helping matters much either. But it is interesting too. I mean, you know, Mick Schumacher's even said that he's ready to debut in Abu Dhabi next week if that should actually happen because of a Roman Grosjean. And, you know, again, there with all these things that have been you know, happening, I mean, he's in next for next season, but who knows? Maybe we get a look at Mick Schumacher before this year is up, too. I mean, yeah, like I say, I mean, 2020 has been weird, but it wouldn't be the weirdest thing we've seen this year.
Formula One really has to be looking at this Mick Schumacher piece less as, hey, this could be an exciting on-track story, as this is going to be an incredible off-track story. And what he could do for Formula One from a commercial perspective, from a marketing perspective, can't be understated. And I think as long as he's with Haas, like he in himself is a paid driver simply because he's going to bring so much exposure and so many attractive sponsorships to that team. And you know what? I was thinking as you were talking, and I don't want to be purely speculative, but if I'm Carlos Sainz and I'm making the transition to Ferrari, and I know that Ferrari's long-term goal is to get Mick Schumacher into a Ferrari, like the pressure's on Carlos Sainz from day one, because Ferrari's already committed long-term to Charles Leclerc. They've done it on paper. They've done it financially. They've done it in the press. They've been very clear about the fact that this is a guy we're investing in for the future. All of a sudden, for Carlos Sainz, this is going to make that situation a little bit tougher because he's on the clock right from day one. And if Mick's able to excel in really problematic circumstances with that Haas team, and to your point, Haas isn't going to be competitive next year, but if he can be competitive in spite of the car, all of a sudden Ferrari's going to be in a position where we could have a driver lineup of Charles Leclerc and Mick Schumacher. And what that could do from a competitiveness perspective and from a commercial sponsorship perspective would be unparalleled. That could put Ferrari back into a position it hasn't been really since Raikkonen was winning titles and winning a title and Schumacher was winning his plethora of titles. Like all of a sudden Carlos Sainz, you know what, he's on the clock himself, and he the poor guy hasn't even sat in a Ferrari racing seat yet and already the clock's on. So this year's gonna be exciting. And you're right, it's crazy too, because we know that Pietro Fittipaldi is going to sit in for Grosjean this weekend, but he hasn't been confirmed for Abu Dhabi. And I think, like you said, by the day, it's becoming less likely that we're going to see Grosjean back in that car, and I don't think we're going to. But ultimately, if I'm Haas, you know, does it make sense to get one of my two new drivers into that car early, given that both of them are already in that region of the world, right? They're already in Bahrain because they're racing in the Formula 2 Championship, which means that they're quarantined, and technically, they could make that short hop over to the UAE and compete in Abu Dhabi. So the reality is, you know, we don't even know what the driver lineup's going to look like next weekend. It's crazy, and it's just super, super exciting. And I never would have imagined that the last two race weekends of the season could have been just so exciting and just so unexpected.
Well, you know, especially after Istanbul a couple of weeks ago, and it was a foregone conclusion Lewis was going to win this championship at some point. But when it officially happens and it's done, and you know the celebration for Lewis Hamilton can begin, you kind of think, okay, well, we got three races left. It's like, okay, well, it's, you know, it's kind of like garbage time in the season. I'm just like, well, you know, it's better than the alternative of listening to the endless rounds of bad news that we get bombarded with constantly. I'm like, okay, well, sure, you know, we still have three races to go, and it's better than nothing. But I mean, the amount of the way that it's really flipped on its head since the Turkish Grand Prix and all the things that have happened as, from Formula One, just from exposure point of view is, it's got a lot of people talking and invested in these last couple of races just because of all these things that are going on. But to your point, just about Carlos Sainz, you know, I keep thinking too that if this doesn't work out for him at Ferrari, you know, he could almost be one of these kind of like, I'm not even sure what the proper word is. Maybe it's just one of these guys that had never really happened for, you know, with Toro Rosso and then with the McLaren and then also that shortstop at Renault and stuff like that. And then, I mean, there's no doubt he's a talented driver, but I mean, I keep thinking too, when you were just talking about, Haas, like you said, is not going to be competitive next year. But I think that's why it makes it interesting to watch what's going to happen with Mick Schumacher, because I'm thinking, could we possibly see something with Mick Schumacher, like we saw with Charles Leclerc with his first season at Sauber Alfa Romeo, whatever they called themselves a couple of years ago. Could we see that? Could we see maybe Mick Schumacher doing things he shouldn't be doing in a car that isn't, you know, the greatest Formula One car? That's what I'm kind of hoping for. But yeah, I mean, to see him, I mean, clearly they want to funnel him into the Scuderia at some point, because like you say, I mean, that is Charles's team. But I mean, that's the moment in time when that became crystal clear to the world last year was at Monza. I mean, there was that debate throughout the year. Charles is faster than Seb. Charles is going to be the future and stuff like that. But when Seb had that unfortunate little off on the opening lap in the Ascari bend and then clipped Lance coming back onto the track, you know, on the opening lap and then just put himself out of contention. And then you had Charles with, the legality of the engine is a bit of a gray area. But that notwithstanding, it was on that day he was faster than the two Mercedes, and despite Bottas and Lewis, you know, tag teaming him throughout that race, he was able to do it, win on home soil. And I mean, you win in Italy in a Ferrari, you're going to be a rock star. But I mean, that's completely put the Vettel versus Leclerc, that question was put to bed. So, I mean, like you say, I mean, he was their boy at that point. They committed to him long term. And then it was always going to be, who's going to, is Vettel going to sign a new contract? Obviously, that never happened. But now, you know, this whole Schumacher thing at Haas really introduces another element into it. And like you say, I mean, it is absolutely, it is fascinating and almost frightening to watch that a guy like Carlos Sainz is already under the gun at Ferrari, and the guy hasn't even put on a pair of red overalls yet. I mean, it is absolutely insane to think that, but it is very much the situation and the pressure cooker that this guy is walking into. And, you know, there's already some talk that, you know, he wants to try to get into that Abu Dhabi test, into the Ferrari and things like that. I mean, you can see why. I mean, he must be, if he doesn't feel like there's eyes on, he doesn't have that feeling of, being watched constantly. I think he's going to have that feeling, starting pretty soon, because it's going to be, it's going to be a difficult place for Carlos Sainz to be, I think.
I couldn't agree or summarize that more, but it also just speaks to how intense this sport is, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you talk about Major League Soccer or the Premiership or the NBA or Major League Baseball, you know, the careers are decently long. You know, it's not unusual for a player to have a 4 or 5 or 7 or 10 or 15 year career. In Formula One, if you really look at the average career of these drivers, it's not long. And we talked about Stoffel Vandoorne. This is a guy who really had a cup of coffee. And you know what? It wasn't necessarily his fault. It was just circumstance and timing and situation. But you know, you don't get those second opportunities very often in Formula One, just because at the end of the day, there's 20 seats. They're highly coveted. And for a lot of these drivers, you know what? They're often competing with pay drivers who bring a really significant, I would say, bundle of capital with them, in addition to typically being fairly competitive drivers. And again, you look at a Williams team, Williams is always going to lean towards a driver that can bring some degree of capital to the team, simply because that's a requirement for them to maintain their operations. And maybe they can have one really strong academy driver, but yeah, like the opportunities just don't come up that often. And I think for Carlos Sainz, I feel like unless Mick has an absolutely phenomenal year in year one with Haas, very much like you said Charles Leclerc did with Sauber Alfa Romeo in 2018. I feel like Ferrari's probably going to want to let him nurture, or they're going to want him to nurture him a little bit with Haas for maybe a year or two. But if he's showing flashes, I think Carlos is going to be looking over his shoulder right away. And I think the pressure is going to be on him from day one, which is going to make this offseason exciting. It's going to make next season incredibly exciting. And then obviously going into 2022, and I don't want to get ahead of myself, but that is
it's hard not to
at this point. Yeah, like that's the year we're going to see the new regulations, and we're going to see potentially more parity in the sport, and we're going to see a cost cap. And whether that applies to drivers or not, that's not necessarily clear yet. At least if there is, it will be outside of the Concord agreement. But yeah, the next couple of years are going to be very, very, very exciting.
Well, the other thing too that makes it doubly difficult for Carlos Sainz at this point is that he's going into Ferrari at a point where they're not at their most competitive. And the brass has come out and they've said, you know, we don't really expect to be in a competitive place until 2022 is what, you know, they've been quite, open about it. And that kind of makes sense because, you know, we've seen, I mean, these cars are basically just, developments on the 2019 cars kind of like stretched out to their absolute max. And you can see, I mean, the car wasn't great last year. It was a lot worse this year, and it's only going to be a development and going into next year. So I mean, it's very much a very sort of a Van Dorn-esque kind of situation, a decent driver in the right place but perhaps at the wrong time. So
absolutely,
it's really going to be it's going to be interesting to watch and see what he can do with that. But just to your point though, just about like the length of careers in Formula One, I mean, you nailed it so well there. I mean, your guys like your Alonso's and your Raikkonen's, I mean, they're the bit of the outliers in Formula One. I think sometimes that really sort of colors our perceptions a little bit. I mean, for everyone like that, like your Kimi Raikkonen or Fernando Alonso, that has like a 20 plus year career in Formula One. How many other guys are there that maybe stick around a year or two or something like that? Not very often. I mean, usually it's for the smaller teams that you got to get these guys rolling in and out and stuff like that. So it will be interesting to see, what happens to Carlos Sainz. I don't want to call him poor old Carlos yet because we're definitely not there, but certainly he has his work cut out for him. So I don't know, Mark. What do you think? Is are we at the point yet where we can strike a line through this week? Is there anything left to be said? Because we've sat here for the past hour or so, and we've talked about it constantly off the air between us for the past several days. I don't necessarily feel like that here between my ears that anything. It still doesn't seem linear. It still seems like a bunch of things, and it might be several days still before I get my mind about around what's happened over the past 4 or 5 days in Formula One.
It's very interesting as well that we're going to go into a race weekend this weekend. So it's the second of a triple header, the second race in Bahrain, but we're going to be running really what's fundamentally going to be an oval. And I for the listeners that might be writing off this weekend as a result, because I think amongst Formula One fans, there's often a really negative perception of oval type racing, and it's an attribute of Indy or it's an attribute of NASCAR. I think it's going to make for an incredibly exciting weekend. And don't think for a second that a race like that is easy on the drivers. This is almost flat out racing from the minute the lights go green to the minute they cross the finish line. Like there's no heavy braking zones. There's no moment where they can collect their thoughts. It's going to be full out racing for the 50 or 60 laps. They're going to be sub 60 second laps. It's going to be in crazy. And I think the other thing that's really, really fascinating about this as well is that from a driver perspective, they're not used to this type of driving. Like they're not used to this type of racing. This is something that's going to be fundamentally new for them. And from a simulator perspective, they haven't had the opportunity to do this virtually either. This is going to be a fascinating race weekend. And for all the reasons that we talked about, I can't wait for Friday morning because I can't wait to see what free practice one looks like.
Well, absolutely. And the thing is, too, is that they keep calling it the Oval, but it is not oval in the sense of, say, Talladega or Indianapolis or something like that. It has the long straight that we see at start finish, and then you go into that the little dog leg, which famously was the place where Romain Grosjean had his big accident. Then you go down the other straight into turn four, and then where in turn four you start to turn into the inner part of the the track at Bahrain there. This is where you go through a series of kind of flowing corners through turns 5, 6, 7, and 8. And then once you get through turn 8, there's a couple more turns. I mean, turn 8, you go up into turn 9. It's a fairly short run, and then it's a very, you know, it's not a very big bend. So that's going to be a very high speed corner. And then you've got a long run down to turns 10 and 11. So between turn 9 and 10 is an equal sort of length as you'd see at start finish. And then you get a pretty sharp turn into turn 10, which is about a 90 degree angle. And then a very, very short run up to turn 11, which then brings you back to the start finish. Well, I mean, turn 9 is basically where they come out of the infield back onto the track that we as we know it, but just getting through that, they get that extra run from turn 8, which is really going to make it interesting to watch. And I mean, you know, they're talking about sort of like 53 to 55 second laps, which is really, really quick. I mean, especially by Formula One standards. I mean, I'm sure that we're going to look at them like, oh my god, look at the number of laps we're going to be running. But I mean, you just watch the way that that's going to tick down pretty quickly on Sunday afternoon. It's going to be interesting to watch, because I mean, especially when you watch some of the shorter tracks on the Formula One circuit, say like your Monacos and like your Red Bull Rings and places like that, where you're lapping about a 1:10 or something like that, those certainly seem like short laps. But when you're shortening that lap time by another 15 seconds or so, I mean, that really is going to be a blink of an eye. But the thing is, too, I mean, that oval or the outer circuit at Sakhir, it's not short. I'm not sure. I don't have the stats in front of me. So, I mean, the fact that they're going to be doing this in about, under 1 minute is really, really, here we go. It's 3.5 yep. Kilometers. So just over 2 miles in length. So about 2.25 miles. So there you go. I mean, it really is going to be fun, especially when you get into that sort of middle half of the track between turns 4 to 8, where you get like those bends and some of the tighter corners. So it's there's going to be plenty of action. And like you say, I mean, these cars and these drivers, they're not really made or prepared for this sort of configuration or this type of racing. And it's going to be fun to watch, no doubt about it. And with that, I think from my point of view, I'm good. I've got nothing left to say. And I think you've got to the point that we've pretty much said everything that we can, although I'm sure we could keep going, but eventually we would just end up like Formula One and just going around in circles with perhaps maybe less action-packed results. But anyways, well, that's it then. I guess we'll wrap it up there. So thank you all for downloading and listening and watching to the show on YouTube. Enjoy the race this weekend. We'll be back, as always, to wrap it up on Sunday night. And of course, we still got one more race to go after that. So we're not quite done. We're getting close. But we still have a couple of races to go. Anyways, if you want to get in touch, best way is to do so on social media, Instagram, Twitter. Look us up, Scuderia F1 Pod, or email if you want to send in some comments or feedback, scuderiaf1pod@gmail.com. And that's it. That's a wrap. Enjoy the race, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.